It's nice to be with you here in Los Angeles. I was saying last night at the Living Temple when we did the talk that LA plays a big role in my life. When I first was sort of brought into the public eye, and believe me, that wasn't by my own intention. Of course, I've researched these things for years, as Wendy has said, but it wasn't. I never thought I was actually going to do it publicly. And when life or destiny or what have you threw me into the public eye around the year 2000, it was actually in LA that I began. So, you know, it's been 3 years that Robin has wanted to bring me down here to his wonderful forum, and also here at the Granada Forum. So it's been a long time in the making, but again, especially for me, it's quite important and significant that I'm back in LA after so many years. So it's great to be with you all. We're going to actually start with a little clip. I want to show a video clip from John Greenwald first to set the stage of the presentation today. So we can, with no further ado, run the DVD. Ted, whenever you want. Okay. This will sort of just preview some of what we're going to go into tonight.
We found the weapons of mass destruction. You know, we found biological laboratories.
Everybody knows that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
I have reason, every reason to believe that the intelligence that we were operating off was correct.
No question we have said that Saddam Hussein possesses biological and chemical weapons.
We know where they are. They're in the area around Tikrit and Baghdad and east, west, south, and north.
All this will be made clear in the course of the operation for whatever duration it takes.
Are you confident that you'll also find weapons of mass destruction?
I believe we will find evidence of the programs of chemical and biological weapons, yes.
How about the actual weapons?
Well, I just don't know. Let's wait and see what the team that's over there.
Continue with our new exploitation teams that have been brought in.
And that we will in fact find weapons or evidence of weapons programs that are conclusive.
It is somewhat puzzling, I think, that you can have 100% certainty about the weapons of mass destruction's existence and zero certainty about where they are.
Do you agree? And does it matter whether or not you find
those
weapons?
We might ask the Prime Minister that we won't be proven wrong.
This is a process that takes some time, and it will ebb and flow.
One thing we know is that he had a weapons program.
I don't know anybody that I can think of who has contended that the Iraqis had nuclear weapons.
We believe he has, in fact, reconstituted the nuclear weapons.
But on the specific issue of weapons of mass destruction, it's going to take time, and we're going to have to be patient.
For time, the truth will come out.
Now, it's going to take time to find anything because they've had...
We will find that we presented a solid case, a case that is there and was there and will remain there.
So it's going to take a period of time to find the people. I don't think we'll discover anything myself.
I still thought that 3.5 months for new inspections was a rather short time before cooling day. And especially when we now see that they say, the U.S. government is saying that, look, you have to have a bit of patience. You know, these things take time.
I believe that... We will find the truth, and the truth is he was developing a program for weapons of mass destruction.
I think what will happen is we'll discover people who will tell us where to go find it.
You're not going to find it simply in a house-to-house search. You're going to find it when people start to talk to you.
It is not like a treasure hunt where you just run around looking everywhere hoping you find something. I just don't think that's going to happen. The inspectors didn't find anything, and I doubt that we will.
Are people going to find out the truth, and the truth will say that this intelligence is good intelligence, no doubt in my mind.
What we will do is find the people who will tell us. There are a lot of people who lie and get away with it, and that's just a fact.
He has not developed any significant capability with respect to weapons of mass destruction. He is unable to project conventional power against his neighbors.
We are able to keep arms from him. His military forces have not been rebuilt.
Is U.S. credibility on the line over weapons of mass destruction in Iraq?
I'm not exactly sure what that means.
Thanks to John Greenwald. That was from John Greenwald. Uncovered the war in Iraq. It's just recently been released. So thanks to John Greenwald for that little clip. What was that clip shown for? sad to say, your president is a liar. The administration is a liar. Who are these people? What are they doing in power? How do they get there? The first thing we need to understand about this is that, of course, these individuals are not particularly from this country. You may be nationally an American, but that does not mean that you actually serve this country. And that's the thing that we have to really clarify for people. Because they speak in American accents, and they may even say, hey, I was born here. But these people have allegiances to other forces that you're not meant to know about. And we are now in the age where we're going to know about those allegiances. Because these people are servants of Vatican. These people are servants of the British royal family. And their job is to undermine and destroy the greatest country on the face of the earth. And they're doing an excellent job at it. And there's reasons for that, and we're going to look at those reasons. They have a mandate that's been handed down hundreds of years ago, actually from the inception of the country. And it is to target this country and make sure that it does not rise to the glory that it is capable of. And unfortunately, as I said, they're doing a marvelous job at it. They will receive their pats on the backs. They've already received their knighthoods from Her Majesty the Queen. I mean, that's documented. But what have they really done? You see, inner atrocities that happened within the confines of America, and Waco jumps to mind, you know, but the Randy Weaver case, and we all know there's many more. The information that Ted Gunderson, John DeCamp have gone through, we understand that there's enormous injustices that have taken place in America. But you see, what you have to realize is that that doesn't really send many ripple effects abroad. It doesn't put people, you know, realizing that there's jeopardy in the United States. That's just America's problem. So these inner atrocities, they don't resonate around the world. A tragedy, therefore, had to be devised that would ruin the U.S. reputation globally. And that is what has happened. America is not now known as a country that doesn't honor international law, human rights, or religious freedom. And American tourists are going to pay for that. It's the same as sabotage from within, as the Roman philosopher and statesman Cicero said. A murderer is less to be feared. They already warned us about it. As President Mubarak said, he has never seen such anti-American feeling being as strong as it is today throughout the world. So if you wanted enemies, you've got them now. Because Al-Qaeda is a fiction created by what you jokingly call neocons. Neocons is just a catchphrase used by the other side. It really doesn't have much meaning at all. A neocon is a skull and bones man, is what a neocon is. A neocon is a Straussian, a follower of the philosophy of Leo Strauss and other demagogues like that who prefer not to come in front of the camera. A neocon is a Russell Trust agent and a Freemason. And they are themselves lieutenants for other powers. And their job was to create enemies of America. They are enemies already on domestic soil, and now their job was to create foreign enemies with the idea that this country is beset by enemies and is thought of wrongly and is considered wrongly. Well, why not? The proof is there, isn't it? I've said in my other works, and Anthony and Jordan have gone into this, that these individuals are obviously related to the dynasties of old. Father George and his wife Barbara are both descendants of Godefroy de Bouillon, who in 1099 was leading European noblemen in a successful crusade to recapture Jerusalem from the Islamic faith and moved into the king's palace there at Temple Mount. And Godefroy was the first king of Jerusalem and the Duke of Lower Lorraine, a major region of the Illuminati bloodline. Bush is closely related to every European monarch on and off the throne and has kinship with every member of Britain's royal family, the House of Windsor. But the Windsor is, again, a catchphrase. Windsor had to be created because they all have such thick German accents that the British people were going to wonder, who is this that's just moved in here at Buckingham bloody palace? No, it's Saxe-Coburg-Gotha. Right? It's the Guelph dynasty. It's the Habsburgs and the Hanoverans that is behind the Windsors. And when the red phone rings, Bush jumps. He's related to her daughter, Queen Elizabeth. So want to know who's behind Bush? There it is. And he is 13th cousin once removed from the heir of the throne, Prince Charles. These are oligarchs. These are aristocrats. And, of course, because of the wars and the rise of rebellion, they can't operate openly anymore from the throne and hang people in the streets like they used to do in my country, where the nobleman, the lord, would literally stand on his balcony and watch the rebels be hung, drawn, and quartered. They know if they try that, they'll be overthrown. So they change tactics just a little bit and put people that are officially not known to be related to them in power. And they achieve what they want in that way. Now, Bush's family tree can be documented as far back as the 15th century. He's connected to Edward I of Longshanks, that all the Scots know as the Hammer of the Scots, who decimated and murdered up there. It's business as usual for these people. And the Bouillons were servants, though, of Pope Gregory VII, particularly Godefroy. He didn't just dream up this idea of his own. He was sent. He was an agent, as his descendants today are agents. He was sent by the Pope Gregory VII and Urban II. And his wife, that's the senior Bush, of course, him and his wife are both related to the same British monarchs. And Clinton and Dole and Gore, the rest is the same. I go into that in my other works. We have the phenomenon of the White Pope. But the White Pope is just the head of the official organ, the official Roman Catholic religion. Behind him is the Black Pope. And behind the Black Pope, for those who are familiar specifically with my work, is the cult of Aton. And these hierarchs are of the ancient Egyptian world, the old Israelite Egyptian pharaohs of old, a whole other concept that we don't have time to elaborate on now. But those who are familiar with my work will understand that there's a worship of the dark side of the sun, which Christians call Luciferianism. And they're not far wrong, actually. They're not far wrong. But I prefer to call it Atenism, the worship of the sun church that Jordan has spent his whole life elaborating on, the solar church. What is the solar church? These people that we're talking about today are lower henchmen, servants, lieutenants of this great power. But specifically, Bush answers to the Queen and also to the Black Pope, who at this point in time is Peter Hans Kolvenbach and his coterie, Opus Dei, and many of the other orgs that they control in this country, including the media. As David Icke said, the Queen of England made Bush's military chiefs, Colin Powell and Norman Schwarzkopf, honorary knights of the British Empire. And the senior Bush is indicted for services rendered also in the First War of Iraq. Of course. But for any American to get on his knees to those people in Buckingham Palace is an obscenity. That alone should have had them thrown into the Atlantic Ocean where they belong. Right. How dare they, that a few hundred years ago, you were fighting these people. They were all at war against these tyrants. The Tsar of Russia wasn't your enemy. The Art of Mongolians weren't. Certainly not the Afghanistan and Saddam Hussein, no. The enemy of America, as I've said many times, was Britain. So what are they doing giving the keys of the city of New York to the Queen of England just a short time after? What are these guys doing getting on their knees? Well, they're doing it because they have to. They're going home to say, pat me on the back, now I've done my job. America's sinking a little bit further into the grave. Where's my medal? Where's the schools that my kids are going to go to? You see, all those privileges. I don't care about the American people. I care about my life, my family. Henry Ford, who was a little bit onto some of this stuff, he was off in many areas, but the man had a sort of a glimmer, same as Howard Hughes, into what was going on. And one thing he said I agree with, he said people deserve the government they get. We're going to see in this presentation that he is exactly precisely right, probably more than he even knew. We do deserve the governments we get, and we're going to find out how we bring those governments into existence. In my work specifically, unlike a lot of other researchers in this field, I do not leave consciousness at the door. I've always stated and will continue to state until the end that no matter how many other permutations that this conflict takes on, like Federal Reserve, you see, or IRS, or endless vaccinations, you see, or war in the Gulf, you see, or any other kind of permutation that's out there in your face in the physical time-space continuum, any of these horrors that are taking place, illegal immigration, the list goes on. The real world war is a psychic one. The real war is on consciousness. And too many people are forgetting this in this conspiratorial movement, so to speak, or in alternative history. And I will not ever make that mistake. Science has often left consciousness at the door, and look at what has happened to science. Now it has to bring it back in because the science basically run aground in the 1970s from all the time of leaving consciousness out and so-called objectivity. But we must not make the same mistake. So no matter whatever permutations of the tyranny that you see openly, as awful as that is in the 3D world, never forget first that it's all about attack here. It's they live. It's psychic dictatorship. What is government? The proof is in the words, the etymology. From the Latin gubernare, or the Greek gubernon. And those words mean to control. And then, of course, you can look it up anywhere. Mente simply means mind. So government literally means the control of the mind. Ladies and gentlemen, nothing is hidden from us. Nothing. It's right there for the person to see. But my question is, then, how is this accomplished? Once we understand that it's a psychic tyranny and they're trying, you know, to control our minds as well as our lives, We want to discover a little bit more about how that's accomplished, because we are in the age of solutions now. So I ask you a question. How many people have been to the optician recently? Right. And I think it's, what's the price for just a simple, just a normal cursory, run-of-the-mill diagnosis of even one eye? Isn't it like $300 a bill? Huh? It's about $75. And I've heard that in some places, you know, for a little bit further diagnosis or for a real treatment, it can cost up to $300 per eye. You can be walking out with almost a $1,000 bill just for a checkup on your eyes from an optician. Well, then I ask the question, what is the price we're willing to pay for the boon of clear mental vision? What do we owe the teachers of the world who help us come to clarity when we're in a delirium? What do we owe the Jordan Maxwells of the world? The teachers who walk very close to us to say, my goodness, you know, and what they end up doing the thinking for all of us. They first have to do the thinking for themselves, and then they find out they've got to do the thinking for their brothers and sisters who say, no, I don't want to think. Can you not do the thinking for me? That's too much trouble. And we have to understand as we become teachers ourselves that really, as I've often said, the word teacher is synonymous with the word threat. Try waking somebody up from their delirium and you will soon find that you're a threat. Try even talking about, you know, fluoride in the toothpaste. Or don't have your children vaccinated with hundreds of vaccines, and you're going to find that you're immediately a threat, even amongst the people that are closest to you. And we don't want to have that clear vision that the teacher is trying to bring us to, or the shaman is trying. No, we want to edit. So when a lot of people are saying, look, I live in a harmonious world. I don't see any of this stuff going on. I'm looking for peace, love, and harmony. What they really mean is that they are editing out the ugliness so that they can be in that one season world. But the man who's using his whole mind doesn't do that. And then say, oh, I'm living in Shangri-La. Because they've beautifully, carefully, and methodically edited out the ugly side of life. They're unintegrated souls. Based on tonight's talk and a lot of my work with 2012, I got some new ideas. They're really not, no ideas new. But now we are coming into another age where we can revisit some of the great gnosis of the past. I'm not going to go into rehash the same stuff I put on the 2012 DVD about the Nephilim and their particular agenda of vacating the planet. That's all been rendered already. I'm not going to waste your time with stuff that you can visit in other areas. We've got some new information, a slightly different slant on these things. In the divination reading, and there's a very short one, there's hardly any predictions for after 2012, but the one that exists is about the sun, Ahu, the light from which we emerge and the light to which we will return. Now, of course, all people of intense knowledge mystically, like the Maya or like the Irish Celts, when they said even a word like the sun, they didn't just mean that ball up in the sky. They meant also the sun in here, the sun of rational intelligence, when they're talking about that day. And the little prediction goes something like, this year anchors a spiritual certainty and the understanding of the cycles of time. So they're talking about time is going to be key. Well, of course, we know that the sun is important because the sun is crossing galactic center. At that particular junction, on 21st of December 2012, the sun will be, you know, in conjunction with galactic center. So the sun is important. And cycles of time, which preoccupied the Maya, will be important. And cycles of time have always been important. We have the famous 12 signs of the zodiac. And what we need to realize, without going into all the astrological information that I deal with in other areas, in the DVDs and so on, in the great cycle of the zodiac, those 12 signs, we are here. Now, the sun takes 2,160 years just to go through one sign of the zodiac, and takes about 25,920 years to go through the whole lot, which is called the Platonic cycle. But we are now, in that time clock, very late in the sign of Pisces, almost approaching the age of Aquarius. And people have different dates for that. Some people say it's only 150 years off. Others say, no, it's more like 700. You know, when you're talking about thousands and thousands of years, that's a minute. That's a very, very, very small amount of time. So it really doesn't matter. Ultimately, we are on the cusp of a change and the move into what they call the new age. And we'll talk a little bit about that. And again, we have from the older civilizations like the Brahmins, again, a fixation on the cycles of time. And I'm a bit dubious about the endless expanse of time that they associate in their calendar. I think this is not wholly accurate. But the idea, again, just briefly, is that they also believe in great cycles. They understood that civilization are born, they come to their peak, and then they collapse, they dissolve. Other people more recently are talking about the photonic action is something that's tying into 2012. And I cover that in the DVD because it's very interesting. I'm not wholly a believer in it, but I present the information because it's very intriguing, this thing. That they're saying, yes, and in a very long cycle, in one of the great orbits that we have, of about 23,000 years, for 2,000 years, and it happens twice, the whole of our solar system passes through a belt of photonic action. Now, photons are the highest form of light that we know. And we'll talk about photons a little bit later in the connection to consciousness again. And they say that that is like a spring clean time. And we better be prepared because we may be heading for another one of those. That's intriguing. And that, wait a minute, we're not only having civilizations which rise and fall, but we also have that they go through cleansing cycles. Whole solar systems can go through cleansing cycles. But then the philosophers have always said it. Plato, Vico, they've all contemplated. Oswald Spengler, all the historians know or have philosophized or theorized that there is this cycle of time. The chaos, theocracy, aristocracy, democracy. The Brahmins often talk about the god Brahma, who is the ruler of the creation, the Atman. And they say that one of these enormous cycles, like their most lengthy cycle of billions and billions of years, they say it's like a blinking of the eye of Brahma. It's nothing more than a day and a night in the life of the creator god. That's how they figure it. But of course, you can't talk about 2012 without the whole idea of prophecy and prediction. If you, in fact, buy into the idea that it was a prediction in the first place. The Maya talking about that at a certain date, around 1999, that will be the beginning of a 13-year countdown to the year 2012. And they said that is when history is going to end. That sounds like a prediction. I look at it as no more of a prediction than a master chef who's preparing a dinner and then he tells you what it's going to be. He knows he's making a souffle. There's no more prediction than that. If you know the meal is going to be prepared, it's not really a prediction in the hard sense when you say this is going to be the outcome and this will be the cooking time. Well, these guys studied astronomy. They had 22 zodiacs, and 22 calendars, the Maya. They were highly sophisticated. And these people may have been descendants of the old Atlanteans of old. They're preparing the dish that we call history. And they know when the closing dates are coming. So you can call it a prediction if you like. But when it comes to predictions, there's many of them, down through the centuries. The message of the dissolution and the atrophy has been long. Here from the Puranas, which themselves are, you can't even date the Puranas, they're so many thousands of years old. The Purana says, there will be contemporary monarchs reigning over the earth, kings of churlish spirit, violent temper, and ever addicted to falsehood and wickedness. They will inflict death on women, children, and cows. They will seize upon the property of their subjects and be intent upon the wives of others. They will be of unlimited power and their lives will be short, but their desires insatiable. People of various countries intermingling with them will follow their example. Wealth and piety will decrease until the world will be wholly depraved. Property alone will confer rank. Wealth will be the only source of devotion. Passion will be the sole bond of union between the sexes. Falsehood will be the only means of success in litigation, and women will be objects merely of sensual gratification. External types will be the only distinction of the several orders of life. A man, if rich, will be reputed pure. Dishonesty will be the universal means of subsistence. Weakness, the cause of dependence. Menace and presumption will be substituted for learning. Liberality will be devotion. Mutual assent will be marriage. Fine clothes will be dignity. He who is the strongest will reign. The people unable to bear the burden of heavy taxes, I guess they had their problems too, right? They had IRS back then, will take refuge amongst the valleys. Thus in the Kali age will decay constantly proceed and the human race approaches its annihilation. Hermes Trismegistus from 150 AD. So the gods will depart from mankind, a grievous thing, and only evil angels will remain, who will mingle with man and drive the poor wretches by main force into all manner of reckless crime, into wars and robberies and frauds, and all things hostile to the nature of the soul. Darkness will be preferred to light, and death will be thought more profitable than life. The pious will be deemed insane, and the impious wise. The madman will be thought a brave man, and the wicked will be esteemed as good. In the 1600s, 17th century, Pastor Bartholomaeus, the mystic, says, a great change will come to pass, such as no mortal man will have expected. Heaven and hell will confront each other in this struggle. Old states will perish, and light and darkness will be pitted against each other with swords. But it will be with swords of a different fashion. With these swords, it will be possible to cut up the skies and to split the earth. A great lament will come over all mankind, and only a small batch will survive the tempest, the pestilence, and the horror. From the Norse Edda of the Teutonic people, an incredible tradition stretching back to the dawn of time, the high priestess, the druidess, says in a prediction, she said, then saw she wade in heavy streams men, foul murderers and perjurers, and them whose other wives seduced to sin. Brothers to slave brothers, sisters, children shed each other's blood. Hard is the world. Sensual sin grows huge. These are the sword ages, the axe ages. Shields are cleft in twain. Storm ages, murder ages, till the world falls dead. And then from the Celts, and this is from 5,000 years B.C., after a great battle between the forces of light and darkness in Ireland, at a very famous mountain in Northern Ireland, they were standing there addressing the conquerors. But in the middle of the festivities, the queen, the high druidess, stood up and said, "Ah, but we better realize that our glories and our age, in fact, is short, because we are to be followed by something awful that comes later." And the prediction was written down by the monks, and it's verbatim, she said. She added a prophecy in which she foretold the approaching end of the divine age and the coming of a new one in which the summers would be flowerless, the cows milkless, and the women shameless, and the men strengthless, in which there would be trees without fruit and seas without fish, when old men would give false judgments and legislators would make unjust laws, when warriors would betray one another and men would be thieves, and there would be no more virtue in the world. Look outside the window. She was right. Now, whether these guys are tracking the zodiac, you know, the whole divination, the stuff that I study and teach, maybe that's how they understood this, or maybe this clairvoyance, it really doesn't matter. The point being, these people knew that something was coming. They were obedient to the cycles of time. They studied nature and understood that if you have a summer, it will be followed by a winter, that there are winter cycles that not only consciousness goes through, but also that nature goes through, and time. Even in the Bible, we find hints of this dissolution and the ending of the ages. Broken down is the city of chaos, says Isaiah. Every house is shut up so that no one can enter. In the streets, there is an outcry. All joy has reached its eventide. All mirth of the world is gone. Desolation is left in the city, and its gates are battered in ruin. You think they're just talking about physical buildings? Don't these people who wrote this know that civilizations come and go? They're talking about some other kind of house that's battered to ruins. The house of the brain, the house of consciousness. Now, what we want to look at is this question that I go to very much in the Atlantis book, which deals not only with the origins of evil, but with the origins of the ego itself, our waking consciousness, the thing we use every day when we wake up. In the book, we read about the deep and intense emotional and psychological trauma experienced by the survivors of the genetic interference, the flood, and the later pole shift. And we can argue amongst ourselves forever of which of those was the more traumatic. I think it was the first one, but boy, oh boy, you know, the rest are pretty bad as well. And I contend that the ego of man, the center of his waking consciousness, may be of recent origins, coming about as an artificial center of consciousness due to this horrific trauma. The ego is a reaction to offset total and rapid psychic breakdown, the effects of which are still being felt. But because its birth was traumatic, its nature and behavior is necessarily vexatious, problematic, narcissistic, and violent. And the history of man is the record of ego existence. The ego is the one writing its own memoirs, which we call history. Now, when the ego wanes in power, history ends, meaning that if the ego, in fact, was born 13,500 years ago to replace the consciousness which was massively traumatized, then it also rises to its peak and comes to a wane. Now, what am I talking about before that? Before that, we had holarchic thinking. We were directly plugged into the matrix. We used the whole brain. But when you're having visitors come here and mess with your DNA, and that's followed by worldwide deluge and worldwide polar shift, the horrendous trauma of that basically destroyed the kind of consciousness that we had at that time, and it fractured. And just in the same way that when you're about to hit a vehicle in your car or you're about to fall because you've slipped on the ice, a muscle becomes spastic in order to what? To prop you up so that you don't completely fall. So in consciousness, there was this reaction. You have to think of consciousness or the ego in this term. It's not a very good metaphor, but it'll do. In order to offset total collapse, the ego was born. And you see the story actually in the first two cards of the major arcana of the tarot. The fool and the magician are the two aspects of this ego that came in. And see, the ego is very proud. Now that it did save us, it's one wants to walk around in flowing robes. It's going, give me complete obedience. Hey, I saved your ass. The ego has done a great deal of work. Now it's the center of consciousness, so to speak. And it's very limited. It's like a sort of an officious office manager. Well, of course it's going to be like that. The executives are out to lunch. The spirit is not with us. So who's running the corporation? The janitor. It's like the guy at the lodge house now thinks he's the lord of the manor. The butler is trying on the clothes of the master when he's away. That's the predicament that we're in right now. When the executives return, the ego will be perfectly happy to just, you know, stay silent and be thanked for its wonderful work. But until that time, we're stuck with it. So the ego, what we are doing our thinking with, is of incredible importance to discover something about it. Because it's artificial. It has a birthday. Do not all the sun gods of mythology start as little children? Whether it's Krishna or Quetzalcoatl or Jesus or King Arthur, you see, or whoever. You can't think of Mithras or Ahura Mazda or Horus and not think of the child. Well, aren't they representatives of the sun? And aren't they representatives of the mind? So then why do they always shown being starting as young children first, even the Buddha? Because there's a metaphor behind that about the very origins of consciousness. And they represent what? God the Father, who's remote and removed from you. And he sends his only begotten Son now. There's something there about the very consciousness that we inside our own heads. In the book, I talk about Adam being the one cut off and divided. He's deeply traumatized. But we've been told that symbolically. Whoever designed the cover of the ET poster, that wasn't some guy just dreaming up that image. He took that image from somewhere. In fact, precisely, he took it from Michelangelo, from the wall, from the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. But Michelangelo is showing God creating Adam. DreamWorks is showing alien creating boy. Are they going to try, are we being told something about this other creation in a right-brained way? I actually believe, as a little bit of an aside, but just for those who are interested, I actually believe that what we call the so-called yogic systems may have actually even been devised for the express purpose of combating the alien proclivities, the healing the major trauma experienced by this genetically altered man, for conditioning out the alien DNA. Basically, yoga had to do, it's not the same as the yoga we're doing today, believe me, but yoga has to do with cleansing and hygiene. That's what it was for. Many of the practices of yoga, meaning just to link back, the word means to link back. That's right, link back to the old ancestral, you know, consciousness that we had before the traumata, with the idea that now we got it, we can't get rid of it, but maybe if we purify ourselves and we have rituals and we have 12-step programs back then and we have shamanic, you know, purifications, maybe we can get back to some sort of semblance of what we were before. Makes greater sense. But this idea that we are creatures of trauma, physiological trauma, that then creates psychological trauma, has been picked up by certain scholars. Telly Kellogg emphasizes the fact that abusive behaviors, whether we direct them towards ourselves, other people, or other species, are not natural to human beings. People enact such behaviors, he says, because something unnatural has happened to them. I and they have become deranged. Now, schizophrenia was studied by two major people. Two major scholars are experts in schizophrenia. One is your American, Julian James, and the other is the eccentric psychologist from England, who's now passed away, R.D. Lang. But Julian James, Jack Barringer in his book Past Shock says of James, James claimed that this period, thousands of years ago, was a time of intense psychosis for the emerging human race. Terence McKenna picks up on it and says that James has suggested that human consciousness has changed its character even in recent historical times. The ego as we know it was not really in existence except under extreme stress. These are scientists who have discovered this through their testing of people. And then it presented itself almost as an exterior intrusion into consciousness, like the voice of a god. Of course, these scholars don't tell you what the trauma was. I do. I know what the trauma was, and it was so severe that consciousness as we know it was shattered forever, except in a few genius types who have a little bit of access, you know, like voices from the distance, like echoes from the past, are the great geniuses of our time. But most of us know it's very, very, and of course we live in a world, make sure we're going to be conditioned into this hyper-linear, not very, very hyper-focused left brain type of mentality. David Watson in his book Pathology of Civilization says that we reproduce catastrophe because we ourselves are traumatized, both as a species and individually, beginning at birth. Because we are wounded, we have put up psychic defenses against reality and have become so cut off from direct participation in the multidimensional wilderness in which we are embedded that all we can do is to navigate our way cautiously through a humanly designed day-to-day substitute world of symbols, a world of dollars, minutes, numbers, images, and words that are constantly being manipulated to wring the most possible profit from every conceivable circumstance. The body and the spirit both rebel. Of course they rebel. But we were so traumatized that we kind of now have a fear of nature, heavily co-opted by the media, by the way. But we have a bit of a suspicion of that old nature because from one point of view, it seemed to do wrong by us. Our Earth was just being destroyed under our feet like the worst Charlton Heston disaster movie you've ever seen. My goodness. So after that, you see, the ego could say, no, you trust me. Forget all of that stuff. You listen to me. I'm the way sure. I'm the light holder. I'm the one who leads you to security and stability. And we were so traumatized, we've done it. But look at the effects of that now. Now, R.D. Lang says that's something incredible. As a psychologist, he turned the whole of psychology upside down. He said, insanity is a perfectly natural adjustment to a totally unnatural and negative environment. See, this is just an adjustment like anything else. If your world is irrational and insane, and you're doing your best to adjust to it, but the result is insanity, don't blame the schizoid person. Schizophrenia is an adjustment, like all mental disease and even like crime. It's merely a symptom, so don't treat the symptom. Schizophrenia is coined by Eugene Bleuler, and it roughly translates as shattered mind, coming from the Greek schizo, to split or to divide. But remember, these psychotic states are just a compensation. They're a desperate attempt to find a sanity. And the whole human race has been doing it, not just individuals. The psychosis is globalized. And the great genius, of course, Sigmund Freud, who had looked into the psyche deeper probably than almost any other human being, he's discovered something incredible about the split. And his language is even better. He says that starting from speculations on the beginning of life and from biological parallels, meaning he studied physical things, I drew the conclusion that besides the instinct to preserve living substance, there must exist another contrary instinct seeking to dissolve those units and bring them back to their primeval inorganic state. That is to say, as well as Eros, there was an instinct of death. And he called that the Thanatos complex. And you'll see in a minute why we're going into this much detail about the death instinct. But Gnostics would always say, hey, we know all about that. We know about the troublesome ego. Thousands of years ago, or hundreds of years ago, we have the Gnostics who said, yes, that's Lucifer. That's the god that, you know, thinks he's God. That's not the real God. That's the what they call the Demiurge, the king of the world, Rex Mundi. That's your problem. They knew that. I prefer to use more simple language and get this message through to people. Let's stop thinking that we think with the mind. Let's get around the idea that we think for the mind. Get out of the idea that the ego, the mind, the thing you think your thoughts with, is unique to yourself. That's a luxury. But it's also a lie, by the way. We're thinking for the mind, not with it. Your great Alan Watts, he said, we seldom realize, for example, that our most private thoughts and emotions are not actually our own. For we think in terms of languages and images which we did not invent, but which were given to us by our society. We copy emotional reactions from our parents. Society is our extended mind and body. Absolutely, he's right. What, your name is borrowed, your religion is borrowed, your clothes are borrowed, your ideas are borrowed. Tell me what's unique. Every human being can clearly know what it is that makes them the same as everybody else. We all support the same team. We all vote the same way. We all like such and such. Very few people can tell you what really makes them unique. We belong to schools where they couldn't care less what makes you unique, unless it serves the beast, of course. Then they're very interested. And let's plug into this. Let's overlay on what I'm just saying about the origins of the ego, something else that needs to be taken into consideration. Up until recent historical times, and I mean recent, agricultural age, industrial age, up until recent times, life expectancy of the average human being was between 20 and 25 years of age. So psychologically, if you have a very short physical life, then psychologically, the human being did not progress much further than what is known as the animistic or infantile phase, basically about 13-year-old teenager, at best. So therefore, his world was therefore one of superstition and wild and uncontrollable emotionality and fear of the unknown. The rational apparatus, which affords us a truer reckoning of objective reality, is therefore an exceedingly recent development. And many people in today's world are just as psychologically primitive and as arrested as those rural ancestors, by the way. Hence, the rise of this evangelism and conservative politics. See, in those days, it was just devils or gods. It was very easy, right? If somebody didn't take water from the well, right, you burned them at the stake. Listen, some Latin American countries, it's the same story. In India, where one of my side of the family's from, they're fanatics, they're maniacs. You wear the wrong clothes, the wrong color on the wrong day, and they're ready to execute you. But that was a very comfortable world to just have everything in demons and gods, you see. And now it's being handed out again. Man, I say, is the rational animal, so to speak. He alone can say, I. And can contemplate his own existence and behavior and actively seek to effect change. Animal can't do that. Animal's not thinking about that. They have their own intelligence, though. Don't get me wrong. I'm not denigrating the animal. But we are the only ones who can think about ourselves and think about thought. Now, this capacity is obviously called independence. Have you ever thought about the meaning of that word? But the opposite of that is called collectivism. But this unique capacity of independence is threatening to the establishment who does not wish man to become aware of the two forms of manipulation which contravene his independent thought and action. As Alan Watts said, the most strongly enforced of all known taboos is the taboo against knowing who and what you really are behind the mask of your apparently separate, independent, and isolated ego. The taboo against knowing who you are? You mean to tell me we're going to reach 25 years of age, voting age, working age, and marriage age, but we don't know who we all are? Wonderful. That's great. And then we turn around wondering why the world is in the state it's in. Marvelous. So we address this problem, that we know that there's untold cruelty from the earliest times. From James Hillman, the Canadian psychologist and friend of Carl Jung, he said that archaeology supports the view that warfare is a development of only the past 10,000 years. Oh, that's a blink of the eye, 10,000 years. Of course, it ties into research of people like myself who are saying, well, we were visited. We were genetically tampered with. And now the psychologists and even some of the scientists are starting to back that up. Because I very much believe that, believe me, these penchants for violence, they're not something that's natural to human beings at all. He goes on to say that, look, the normal round of warfare has been going on as far back as memory stretches. But during the last 5,000 or so years, 14,600 wars have been recorded. There's barely a day off before we're butchering somebody else. Schlein is a San Francisco scientist, top of the totem pole, has been looking into the goddess tradition and divination and what it's all about with the feminine concept. Because the old paradigms are simply not working anymore. So scientists are not because they want to, believe me, it's because they're forced to. He says that Eve's descendants have steadily accumulated the power to destroy each other in an unholy Armageddon and, like sleepwalkers, are shuffling towards a planetary ecological disaster. But how could a slight, 5-foot-tall, 2-legged animal create such sublimity and then wreak so much havoc in so minuscule an interval of Earth history? As I've always said, the question of evil is one of the most important questions that we could ever ask. It's number one on the list. Eric Fromm, the post-neo-Freudian, says that the detailed description of the life of primitive hunters and food gatherers has shown that man, at least since he fully emerged 50,000 years ago, was most likely not the brutal, destructive, cruel being, and hence not the prototype of man, the killer, that we find in more developed stages of his evolution. So there's another lie out the door. Oh, well, we're violent because, that's just the way it is. It's evolution. No, it's not evolution. And that big question that so many people have asked, sitting around the coffee table, but the scientists are asking it. The malcontents are asking, what is the real difference between man and beast? The only thing I say to that is, do we really want the answer? I mean, really. Because man does differ from the animal by the fact that he is the killer. He, the only primate that kills and tortures members of his own species without any reason, either biological or economic, and who feels satisfaction in doing so. Animals will eat each other, but they don't murder each other. It is this biologically non-adaptive and non-phyliogenetically programmed malignant aggression, okay, because there's healthy forms of aggression as well, but this is malignant aggression that constitutes the real problem and danger to man's existence as a species. Don't we know it? Because the most ample, he says, and horrifying documentation for seemingly spontaneous forms of destructiveness are on the record of civilized history. The history of war is a report of ruthless and indiscriminate killing and torture whose victims are men, women, and children. Many of these occurrences give the impression of orgies of destruction in which neither conventional nor genuinely moral factors have any inhibitory effect. There is hardly a destructive act human imagination could think of that has not been acted out again and again. Schlein says that creation is in fact a nightmare spectacle taking place on a planet that has been soaked in the blood of all of its creatures. The soberest conclusion that we can make is that this planet is being turned into a vast pit of fertilizer. Actually, it is. And those who have studied the ritualistic component of these killings, the world is still to wake up to that. But there are people who have been studying that. They will understand what that statement in fact does mean. Fromm goes on to say, only man seems to take pleasure in destroying life without any reason or purpose other than that of destroying. Remember, Freud? There's two sides. There's the instinct of death and the instinct for life. And we all have it. Even the most creative of people. Van Gogh can go out one day and paint pictures that will stun the world for hundreds of years and in the same hour cut his own ear off. To put it more generally, only man appears to be destructive beyond the aim of defense or of attaining what he needs. Only man. Thomas Hobbes, and he should know because he's one of the philosophers behind our modern mass murderers, okay? I'll be doing a DVD in the future called Evil's Willing Servants in which I'll be dealing with these hidden people, the Leo Strausses, the Rothschilds, the Thomas Hobbes types of people, some of the people, you know, that they're camera shy. And they're philosophers, they're teachers. And the young men, like the Bushes and the Wolfowitz, they serve these individuals. And they want to get into politics to execute the philosophies of people that you don't know about and are not meant to know about. You've heard of Wilson, but you ain't heard of Colonel Mandel House. So we have to find out who are the architects of deception behind the scenes. Very important. Hobbes says that the state of peace among men living side by side is not a natural state. The natural state is one of war. There are people who believe that. In the French philosopher Joseph de Maistre believed it. He said, I'd say, gentlemen, that dictatorship is a legitimate form of government. Dictatorship, indeed, is part of the divine order. No questions about it. These are the top philosophers of the ages. And we have people executing right now their philosophies. Another psychopath was Juan Donoso Cortez. He says, the culmination of Donoso's philosophical treatise is that the institution of bloody sacrifice is the most universal of all human dogmas and institutions. The most civilized nations and the most savage tribes believe in a pure victim offered as a perfect holocaust. Without the death penalty, without the purifying efficacy of blood, all societal bonds would collapse. So they're saying if you've got civilization, it's based on sacrifice. And there's people who believe that and are operating accordingly right now. Of course, it won't matter to you until your daughter or son goes missing. Then it will matter. And coming more to the point, we have something important that's going to happen this year. We're talking about Mayan countdowns and 13-year cycles and age of revealing and all of that. Well, listen, if you haven't felt it before, it's going to start happening soon. In November of this year, and for the whole of 2007, all the way up to 2012, there's a very major cycle that's going to begin. We've been talking about time and cycle and all of that. Well, there's another cycle you need to know about that's approaching us very, very soon. And it's the coming in of the planet Pluto. Now, I wish I could get more into the concept that when I'm talking about the planets, I'm not talking about the effects of rocks in space with magic rays. People who know my work on astrology know that I know about an inner zodiac. The whole idea is that these rocks in space just represent energies. They are not the thing itself. So don't get me wrong there. But Pluto is an archetype that represents a certain kind of energy that is actually psychological in nature. That's all I can say for now. If you can contact me and we can go into greater depth, there's information on the Taroscope's website more about what I mean by these planets and zodiac. Anyway, we have the planet Pluto. But what is Pluto? What does it matter that it's coming in? Because in November of this year, it's going to be crossing galactic center and channeling energy from the center of the galaxy. And that's in late Sagittarius. Pluto, the planet of destruction, and I prefer the word deconstruction, because really, if you think about it, nothing is ever destroyed. It's just transmuted. And radical change will be crossing galactic center and channeling that energy of the central sun in early 2007. It takes approximately 250 years for Pluto to complete one circuit of the zodiac or 12 signs. We saw the 12 signs. Well, now think of one planet moving very, very slowly. Because the sun and Mercury and Venus and some of the other planets we know, they move very, very quickly. And their effects then are very, very sort of short-lived. Even though if you're sensitive, you can always feel them. That's what astrology is all about, is the mapping and charting of the effect of these bodies. But Pluto moves very slowly and has very, very dramatic effect. Now, Pluto is presently approximately 24 degrees of Sagittarius. Please excuse me if you're not familiar with this astrological jargon. And when it moves into Capricorn, the sign of order and government, Capricorn, right, the sign of order and government, it will auger in cataclysmic upheavals and exposure of all corruption in order to restore harmony. In fact, a lot of what you're seeing in the exposures recently have been because it's moving in. It's already coming. Its orbit is 250 years, so about 3-4 years ago, already, what you might even say, the turn of the millennium, let's say, already the effects of Pluto have been felt. But it's going to get stronger and stronger and stronger, like a dimmer turning up. It augurs in the exposure of all corruption in order to restore harmony and a higher way of being. Individual lives will also be dramatically transformed. Pluto comes to check psychic immunity. We all know about physical immunity. If you don't have it, you've got a disease, right? Pluto is the surgeon coming in to say, roll up the sleeve, say, ah, it's going to check the psychic immunity. And it brings with it a deep cleansing cycle. One can think of it as nature's psychic surgeon. It's interesting, too, because it is connected. Pluto is connected to psychology. Pluto was discovered in 1930, but it had been searched for at about 1900, exactly the time that Sigmund Freud started writing and releasing and publishing his works. Pluto, I believe, is the planetary ruler of Germany, but it is very much the ruler of psychology. And I've always thought it's interesting that the word sanity comes from the same word roots as sanitized, meaning that if you're not sanitized, you're not sane. What do I mean by that? We clean everything in our world. We wouldn't dream of eating off the same dirty plate twice. We make our beds, we take showers, we clean the driveway, right? In Ireland, they're out there polishing their cars on Sunday morning, groom the dog. Everything in our life is clean. How come not our emotions? How come they're as toxic as hell and we're walking around loose in the world thinking, we got problems, let me fix it. Ever try cleaning a nice clean window with an oily rag and then saying you can't see the garden? Well, the oily rag in your hand is the one messing up the window. So if we're finding disorder and chaos in the world, could it be our smudge, our forensic mess that we're leaving behind? Could be in the eye of the beholder, as they say. Now, Robert Hand, the astrologer, says that the nature of Pluto is similar to that of the Hindu god Shiva. It's an interesting statement. Pluto usually begins by breaking down a structure, then creates a new one in its place. The entire cycle of death, destruction, and renovation is accompanied by tremendous powers. For Pluto is not a mild or even a very Pluto is not a mild or even very subtle planetary influence. It brings decay at one level or another. Pluto also rules death and regeneration of the self, as old aspects of your life pass away. Pluto does not represent death in the literal sense. Instead, it refers to a metaphorical death, something that ceases to be. And those who know about this stuff know that when you're feeling the effects of Pluto, it's going to be in your relationships that you're going to feel it first. Forget about Capitol Hill and White House and all of that. You're going to feel it much closer to home. But he mentioned Shiva the Destroyer, the god of the third god of the Hindu Trinity. Now, we don't have too much insight into the sane mind, but we can certainly recognize the unsane mind. At least that much we can do. But in short, the schizophrenic mind creates a schizogenic society. You don't need to be Freud to know that. The pathological mind creates a pathogenic society. The toxic mind sees and creates a toxic world. And we can recognize it on the big scale. But can you recognize it closer to home? Actually, no, we can't. Barbara Hahn-Clough in her Pleiadian Agenda says, you all have miasmas in your bodies that you must release. These are etheric masses that hold memory from genetic past lives. They're disease patterns. And we feel uncomfortable with them. It's time to get rid of them. But we really don't want to do that. We escape from it. That's right. Avoidance and tranquilization. We don't want to do all that psychology and self-investigation. Where's the authority figures who will just lead us where we need to go? They'll teach us all how to do it. But don't you see that by your avoidance to deal with your dark psychic content, that you are in fact funding and permitting the most hideous leviathans to poison and intoxicate the human race? Because they will step on to the white square of the chessboard if you don't occupy it. Then don't blame them for their existence if you have allowed them to rise. Now, Pluto is, of course, anyone here Scorpio? Sun sign Scorpio? Right. Then you know, obviously, that Pluto is your ruling planet. Pluto is your god of the sign of Scorpio. And therefore, where is Scorpio in the seasonal cycle? Right? It's late. It's at the winter cycle. So Pluto rules when the sun goes into the winter seasonal cycle. And it's the same thing psychologically. Pluto rules what is known as the underworld cycle in alchemy or psychology. And, of course, we all go through the underworld cycle, whether we know about astrology or not. It's often been called in the New Age movement the dark night of the soul. Carl Jung said that the foundation of mental illness, all mental illness, is unwillingness to experience legitimate suffering. Because we resist a certain amount of this looking at the dark side, especially of ourselves, and a willing entrance into, because remember, all of us are going through the dark night of the soul, and we'll have to go through this underworld phase, just as the sun has to go through its one seasonally. You're not going to escape it. The only difference is that you can either decide to do it of your own free will, then it's ritualistic, or you can be dragged. The hanged man has a smile on his lips. It's a willing oblation. Did not Odin, when he hung on the tree of life in order to learn the secret of the runes, he did it willingly. Nobody forced Buddha to sit down in front of the tree when he wanted to contemplate the meaning of life. It's a Conan and the Barbarian situation. You must willingly be crucified and die to be reborn again. Of course, we've forgotten all of those rituals, but nevertheless, it goes through your life. It's not that suffering is good. Suffering is built into the universe. You're going to have it just like you have pleasure. It's your unwillingness, unwholesome unwillingness to deal with it and to accept it for what it is, which is like the sword saying, I don't want to go through the fire of the blacksmith. Well, then you're not a sword, period. Now, countries go through these great cycles, the seasons go through it, and so do the psyche. In psychological terms, though, Pluto, Shiva, represents what is known in consciousness as the shadow self. Now, you see, in the schemata of the consciousness, we're out here. We're out here in the realm of persona, which is the word for mask. We're out here in the Hollywood drama, right? The mask, the show of masks. And we become so identified with this extreme edge of consciousness, the fashions, what are we going to look like, you know, appearances, and the whole nine yards. Now, of course, a certain amount of persona we need. Otherwise, we'll be wide open to attack. You need the mask in order to conceal your real identity, to protect yourself and generally, and to operate in the world with other fellow human beings. But we have way overcompensated for it. We've put all our psychic energy into the mask. And you only have to look at the cosmetic commercials to know that it's obsessive right now. Behind that is the ego, the waking consciousness. And its little battery runs down every 12 hours or so, so you need to sleep. That's because it's finite and it's the energy, and you need to sleep to restore its energy. When we wake up in the morning, we have a thing called ego consciousness, ego waking consciousness. But the ego is a strange kind of thing. As I said, it's kind of young and reckless and wild, as well as very domineering. And anything that your ego or you do not like about yourself, you repress. And the repressions of all the stuff that you despise about yourselves becomes what's known as the shadow personality. And it's kind of in the unconscious realm. It's not even in the conscious realm because you're not aware of it. It's like the director's cut of your life. See, when you're living your life and experiencing all sorts of things, you want to have the nice clips that you cut out and put them on the coffee table, the family album. But what about the backstory that's really been filmed, that footage that you hide away? That one day when you leave this planet is going to be played for you in the dark room. They're going to say, come this way. We've got something to show you. Remember all that film you stored away in the attic, meaning your unconscious mind? We're going to run you an amazing film here. This is a real slasher horror one. This is Stephen King and more. You want to see the John Carpenter, you know, Friday the 13th, part 14? Here it is. The shadow is the repressed stuff that we don't show to the world, and we even forget. Now, for those who find it hard to understand what repression is, it's forgetting something and then forgetting that you forgot about it. It's the skeletons in the closet, and again, it's a very necessary part of the human mind. We need it to survive. It's like the dumpster. You need to throw the trash out. But we've, again, overcompensated. We're doing it too much, and it causes enormous psychic problems. Carl Jung said that the shadow is a moral problem that challenges the whole ego personality, for no one can become conscious of the shadow without considerable moral effort. He's talking spiritually there. He's saying that for you to be integrated, you're going to need to integrate with your shadow because those are aspects of yourself that you've thrown away. And you're not getting to the light. See, the self, the true person, is way back here. For the hell, you can forget about the self. We're into ego world. And the ego is doing itself a disservice by constantly denying aspects of its own self. Now, you know something? There was books left out of the Bible. And it's important to start finding out why. Jesus said in the Gospel of Thomas, this is one of the great Gnostic Gospels that was thrown away, when you see your likeness, you rejoice. But when you see your images which come into existence before you, which neither die nor are made manifest, how much will you bear? Now, it's very flowery language, a different language, but can you see now what is being said here? When you see your likeness, you rejoice. Meaning when you're in the persona, and you're in the world of, oh, I play the fashion game, and everybody then gives me acknowledgement, and I give acknowledgement, you rejoice. But when you see the primordial images which come into existence before you, but these which are neither die or made manifest, meaning the unconscious mind, how much then will you bear? It's an old story. And the teacher, remember, the threat. You know what the teacher does? He goes, project on me. I'm your come on, dump it on me. And we do. And the teacher's job is to take all of that. As Carlos Castaneda and other writers have shown. The teacher is, he's the guy we're going to bury in the sand, as we've done so many times before. The shadow is very powerful. It is a moral problem. It destroys relationships, and it destroys the teacher relationship with the one who's receiving the teaching. Yeah, looking at who we are, that's all it's about. The only solution, the solution is to look at who we are. As Alexander Pope said, know then thyself. Presume not God the scan, the proper study of man is man. William Blake said, thine own humanity, learn to adore. But Carl Jung put it this way. He said, look, people will do anything, no matter how absurd, to stop from facing their souls. Ever been outside recently? Ever turned on the TV recently? He's exactly right. People will do anything, no matter how absurd. And all that carnival that you see out there and all the distraction and nonsense that this world is wall-to-wall full of, that's what he's talking about. I must live in the Bahamas. I must live in a one-season world. I don't want to be looking at any of that stuff. Well, then okay. But then you've just condemned the world to horrors. You're just making a person in your life, your partner or your children, the victims, the slaves to your inability to face yourself. You're now having a person fill your void and your emptiness because you're not a whole person. And now you've enslaved that wife or that husband or that child or that animal or your workmates to your own form of tyranny. Yeah, you can't call the police on it, and you'll never get the court over it to prove that it's there, but it's there. And basically, repression doesn't work. There's a thing known as the return of the repressed. You can only dump so much of it before the stench starts to, you know, come back. And as Carl Jung said in a well-known statement, he said, when an inner situation is not made conscious, it appears outside of you as fate. Ha, ha, ha. Because there's a strange contract between the unconscious energy of our mind and the world, the energy that built the world. They conspire together. They're built out of the same stuff. So behind the back of the ego, the unconscious mind, the shadow, conspires with life, with material existence, to bring in front of you the very people, the very person, the very challenges, right, to help you integrate when you won't do it of your own free will. And we call that living. All the stuff that happens around us that we often describe as difficult challenges, that's what that is. We will refuse to do the homework, so then we're going to meet it in space and time. As the Greek said, your character is your fate. Now the next statement from Carl Jung is the one that is basically the theme of the entire presentation. Very important statement, and it is the crux of all of the work that I do, and all of the work that I will continue to do in this field. This is it, because I am not a person who will leave consciousness at the door. I am fully aware of all of the other obscenities that are taking place, you know, in the name of God, in the name of religion, in the name of freedom and sovereignty. But you see, in my book, I will not leave consciousness at the door. And this is the reason. Carl Jung says that the gigantic catastrophes that threaten us today are not elemental happenings of a physical or biological order, but are psychic events. To a quite terrifying degree, we are threatened by wars and revolutions, which are nothing other than psychic epidemics. At any moment, several millions of human beings may be smitten with a new madness. And then we shall have another world war or devastating revolution. Instead of being at the mercy of wild beasts, earthquakes, landslides, and inundations, modern man is battered by the elemental forces of his own psyche. It's just that the other stuff, you know, the symptoms of this, you can take a Polaroid of it. You can catch it on film. And you can call physical police to handle it. But there is a far greater form of violence going on that we are still to educate ourselves in. And it just so happens that the most toxic and unworked people just happen to be in power. So we've just diagnosed them. They just happen to be the ones most infected by the epidemic. And they're walking loose and hoping that you'll catch it too. But they're not what we first think that they are. They're not just mad politicians, you know, wherever. These are people who have an epidemic. And they happen to always rule the societies because we let them. We permit it to happen. The masses of men and women in the Western world compulsively avoid true, authentic, and psychoanalytical investigations of their natures, even with help, particularly in regards to so-called darker aspects of the personality, the shadow self, and so on. However, not dealing with the psyche at all proves systemically hazardous, so a compromise is required. So the ego is not stupid. It knows that continually be dumping without any integration will create total pathology. So it thinks, you know, I'm going to get poisoned by all the stench coming from the back alley. Now, you know, we want the house to look good in the front for the neighbors, but this stench is, you know, creeping in. People are going, is there something rotting around here? So it has to find a way of coming, you know, doing some dumping, so to speak. So a compensation had to be found. And hence the proliferation of the New Age philosophy and movement, together with as many